Today, the story of one teenager's dangerous journey from Vietnam to a UK cannabis farm. And can England win the Rugby World Cup for the first time since 2003? Last Wednesday, in the early hours of the morning, police received reports that 39 people had been discovered dead in the back of a lorry on an industrial estate in Essex. A murder investigation was launched.
Well, Essex police has now charged the driver of the truck, 25-year-old Maurice Robinson, with 39 counts of manslaughter.
Her family say she'd paid £30,000 to smugglers. The Vietnamese embassy in London say they've passed her details to Essex police.
A week on, the police are still trying to work out who these people were. But it's been reported that many of the victims were from Vietnam and were illegally trafficked into the country.
There have been over 3,000 Vietnamese children and adults who've been identified as victims of trafficking between 2007 and 2018. But that's really the tip of the iceberg. The police don't know, the NGOs don't know. There's no way of knowing in reality how many have not been found by the police.
Annie Kelly has reported on modern slavery for The Guardian since 2013.
At the time, there was very little awareness that it was a trade in people. It was people who were visible but unseen.
Her reporting has taken her across the country. Along the way, she heard about a young Vietnamese man we'll call Minh, who arrived in the back of a lorry. His story gives an insight into the hidden lives of the tens of thousands of people who have been trafficked into the UK as slaves. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why are people risking their lives to come to the UK? Just a warning before we start, some listeners may find some parts of this episode distressing.
I first met Minh about a year and a half ago in a safe house. When I first met him, he was 22, but he looked so much younger.
It's a bit difficult for me. I don't know where to start the story.
He was immaculately dressed, you know, really nicely kind of gelled hair. It was staggering to me, knowing what he'd been through, that this was the same person that was sitting in front of me, talking to me about his life now in London.
The first thing was I was distanced from my family.
But, I mean, it only took maybe 10 or 15 minutes into the conversation. You could see that mask slipping and you got an indication of what he'd been through. Just, you know, you could kind of see the child trapped in the cannabis house very quickly when we started talking about his experiences and what happened to him.
What was his life like growing up in Vietnam?
He said that his life had always been hard. He was born into poverty in a village in Vietnam where agriculture was the only way that people were surviving. There was no other work in the region. It's a very similar environment to the place where those 39 people who died in the trailer were from. It's very rural, it's very poor, it's been hit hard by things like climate change. It's not a place where there are opportunities for young people. He always had the belief that the way that he could not only improve his own life but also provide for his parents was to leave.
Do lots of people feel like that in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, the UK is still sold as a dream destination where you will be able to find ample work by smuggling gangs who are making vast profits off taking hundreds, if not thousands, of Vietnamese young people and adults out of Vietnam and on that overland route across Europe towards the UK. There is a very thriving Vietnamese diaspora here in the UK, and there are success stories which also breed that belief that if you can just get to the UK, then, you know, life will be better, not just for you, but it's your responsibility to be able to provide for your wider family as well.
In spite of her smiles, she said she was tired and sorry she'd left her poor mother behind. But in this, her last message, she said growing up was knowing when to hide your sorrow and step into a new life.
And in Vietnam, how do the traffickers operate? to find people?
I think there are a myriad of different ways. I've heard of people being recruited via Facebook. That is just a very common way of people connecting and talking. And so there will be job offers that come through those kind of channels. There will also be somebody in the UK who knows someone in a village who will be able to say that there's an offer of work. If they can just make it there, then they'll be able to get a job in a restaurant or in a nail bar. Other ways, like Min, it's a forced exit. Very vulnerable people are being trafficked off the streets, or people who don't have family are being forcibly removed from the country and sent to the UK into the hands of trafficking gangs. Culturally, I've been told there is this understanding that you need to suffer before you can succeed. And so there is this idea that this is a journey that people have no choice but to make.
They could not apply for such a student visa or business visa. They have to travel by another way.
How much money are people typically paying up front?
I mean, I've heard anything from £5,000 to £30,000-£40,000. Wow. But quite often they're not paying all of that money up front. So these are almost kind of phantom debts that are either accrued on the journey, or they're told when they reach France before they get on the truck, or when they reach the UK, how much it is that they owe their traffickers. It's not costing the smuggling gangs £30,000 to bring someone overland from Vietnam to the UK, but that is the amount of money they're told that they have to pay back.
It's almost the size of the threat that hangs over their heads.
Exactly.
Is determined by how much they say it is.
The debts are used as a way to terrify and coerce and control people.
Tell us about Min's journey to the UK.
From Ho Chi Minh City, he was taken on fake documents and he was flown to the Czech Republic. And from the Czech Republic, he then travelled overland through Eastern Europe to France.
That is a very similar route to what most Vietnamese people arriving
yes.
illegally into this country will take.
That is the main kind of most historic, well-trodden route. I mean, people normally travel through 7 or 8 different countries before they arrive in the UK. People either walk across borders through forests, they will be taken part of that journey in the back of trucks, they will be flown some part, but the overland route is the route that most people take.
How long can these journeys take?
They can take years, 2, 3, or it can be a number of months. There are many different things that happen to people that take this overland journey. A few years ago, the Russian authorities found 1,500 Vietnamese people working in a sweatshop in Russia who were working off to pay for the next leg of their journey. There are Vietnamese people who are exploited in brothels in Eastern Europe.
I can't even imagine how relentlessly awful this is for an individual. What keeps them going?
The debt and the need to work it off. They literally can't go back because no one's going to take them back to Vietnam. Their only way is forward. There's this forward momentum. They've gone on that journey. Their parents have often paid the money, or their community has raised that money to send them. So the pressure on them to be the success story that their family is hoping that they will be is enormous psychologically.
Tiep's last texts say, "I'm on the way there, Mum. You will have to pay £10,500. You need to pay them."
If you think of the text messages, those heartbreaking text messages that came out from the young woman that died in that refrigerated truck.
These are the last distressing messages they received from her, not long before the lorry and its cargo, full of death, were discovered.
She was apologising to her mum for failing, but she was supposed to be the success story for her family.
And one of the very tragic details that came out of the reporting on the 39 found dead in Essex was that the lorry they were in was a refrigerated lorry. Is that also something you've heard of being
yes.
used a lot before?
Yes. I was speaking to a lawyer this morning. He was talking about one of his clients who was also brought over that way as well.
So are these deaths happening perhaps more often than we realise?
39 people dying, that's a terrible human tragedy. But the Vietnamese anti-trafficking and child trafficking experts I've been speaking to were saying that undoubtedly people are lost along the way. They will be uncounted.
What was Min's lorry experience like? Do we know?
He described it as terrifying. I mean, what happened to Min on his journey from Vietnam to the UK was horrendous. He was gang raped, he was beaten, he was not given food or water. It was hard for him to describe it because it was clearly an extremely traumatizing experience. He described the cold, he described the pain of being in this compressed space, of being hungry and scared, being pressed up against these bodies of people he didn't know. You know, he was only 16 at the time as well.
What happened to Min when he got to the UK?
In France, Min had been given a phone number to call when he got to the UK. He called that number. He was picked up by a group of Vietnamese men and he was driven straight to a house in Derbyshire. An empty property where he was locked inside the house for about 2 weeks and left some frozen food to heat up in a microwave.
I didn't know where to go, and I was hungry, I was cold.
A few weeks later, some other men who he described to me as foreigners, not Vietnamese men, turned up with big green cannabis plants and bags of soil and lights and equipment, and they turned this house into a kind of makeshift cannabis farm and then told Min that his job was to look after these plants and make sure that they didn't die. You know, I interviewed Min a number of times over the space of a year and had to piece together his account of what happened in that house, because to him, the house was this terrifying experience that he believes he'll never recover from. He says he was locked inside the house, that he was told not to turn the lights on, he couldn't make any noise.
I was so frightened, very frightened.
It was freezing cold and filthy. The stench of the plants made him feel sick. They gave him headaches. He would sleep on a mattress on the ground floor and the plants were being grown upstairs, and the water from the soil would drip through the ceiling onto his mattress every night. He was constantly terrified that the plants would die because he knew he'd be in terrible trouble if they did. He tried to escape once and was found and brought back to the house and hurt badly enough to know that he would never try to escape again. So for him, it was a horrendous experience.
Is it quite typical that Vietnamese teenagers like Min are getting caught up in this black market?
Yes. Phil Brewer, who until earlier this year ran the Met Police's anti-trafficking and kidnap unit, said to me yesterday that in his view, the Vietnamese control all of the cultivation and provide all of the manpower to cannabis farms across the UK.
Gosh.
So UK's cannabis industry is inexplicably linked to Vietnamese child and adult slavery. The UK's domestic cannabis cultivation has just exploded in the last 5 to 10 years. It's a multi-billion dollar now domestic and export industry.
Because I imagine the format of having cannabis farms in just ordinary homes,
yes,
means that it's very difficult within this kind of system for the authorities to see anything that's being done wrong.
From what I understand, police just literally cannot keep up with a number of cannabis farms that are operational across the UK. It's impossible to be busting them all.
Where else are young Vietnamese people being enslaved in the UK?
There are several industries, both legal and illegal, which are recognised now as being linked to the exploitation of Vietnamese people. Cannabis is one. Nail bars, but also restaurants and also prostitution, so forced prostitution, both Vietnamese men and women being sex trafficked here in the UK as well.
Yeah, is there a sense that when people arrive in the UK, it's very difficult for them to escape the power of their traffickers?
The Vietnamese criminal networks that operate and are in cahoots with these smuggling gangs, this is a ruthlessly efficient, organised criminal operation. The idea that you would go to the authorities, I mean, it's just not going to happen.
The police eventually raided the cannabis farm where Min was enslaved in 2013. Did that mean he was safe?
The short answer is no. Min was not identified as being a victim of child trafficking by Derbyshire police.
When they entered the property, they arrested me. and they handcuffed me.
He was ultimately prosecuted for cannabis cultivation and sent to a Young Offenders Institute, Glenparva. He then served 9 months of an 18-month prison sentence. He was then detained indefinitely under immigration powers when he was in Glenparva and transported directly to an immigration detention centre. At the second immigration detention centre, he was sent to Moreton Hall. He was sexually assaulted by another inmate. He was then kept in detention for another 6 months after that assault until lawyers from Duncan Lewis found him and managed to get him released months later.
So you would have thought that that might have been the point that he could have got to safety, but no, far from it.
It was a process that spanned several years. He should have been treated as a victim of slavery, and instead he was treated as a criminal. It's a very good example of how modern slavery victims are often falling through the gaps in the criminal justice system.
So many times, I think about I'm being with solicitor, trying to fight against the police, home affairs, the court. It seemed too much to me to handle.
During the years Min was detained, the government was beginning to address the issue of slavery in the UK, and the then Home Secretary Theresa May introduced the Modern Slavery Act in 2015.
Modern slavery is an appalling crime that damages too many people's lives. This government is determined to give law enforcement the tools they need to stamp it out.
It was meant to give better protection to victims and greater powers to prosecute traffickers. But 4 years on, prosecution rates are still really low. Do you think it's been effective?
Victims have felt that they have been failed when they have come forward to report their trafficking or when they have been found and referred into that kind of legal framework that the bill set up that's supposed to support and protect them. The levels of prosecutions have remained very low.
I'm under no illusion, as I indicated earlier, about the scale of the task ahead. Stamping out modern slavery will not happen overnight.
It's extremely expensive to conduct a modern slavery investigation and to secure a conviction at the end. It relies on victims coming forward and testifying against their traffickers, and that's a very big ask. I was told yesterday that there were only 2 or 3 Vietnamese mental health professionals operating in the UK. So that means that there are only 2 or 3 Vietnamese people who are able to offer mental health support to victims who've gone through some of the conditions that we've just talked about. And police often really struggle to get translators as well. I mean, Min, for instance, on a number of occasions when he was trying to disclose his trafficking at immigration detention centres, didn't have access to a translator. You know, police shouldn't be social workers. Social workers shouldn't be police, but there needs to be more investment to create the environment in which victims are feel that they can come forward and report what had happened to them.
Is the Vietnamese government doing anything to dissuade people making these journeys or to curtail those people that force individuals like Min into making them?
There has been lots of cooperation between the UK government and the Vietnamese authorities. Policies that have been tried to put in place that will try and kind of increase cooperation between the two countries in order to try and stem the smuggling and trafficking routes out of the country towards the UK. From what I hear in Vietnam, that those messages aren't getting through to the villages where the 39 people who died last week came from. Certainly not for people like Min. There is no disincentive to leave Vietnam.
Min won £85,000 from the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice for the way he was treated. And then last year, his criminal convictions were overturned. All the agencies he came into contact with have also apologised to him. How's he doing now?
He's in a much better position now because he's in safe house accommodation. He is still waiting to know whether he's going to be granted leave to remain. So that's the one thing that's hanging over him. He still doesn't know whether he's going to be allowed to stay and to continue his recovery here.
Like now, I look much older than... older than before.
The last time I saw him, which was a few months ago, he was... You know, he was hopeful for the first time. But, you know, I think he still feels that what he has gone through will define, in a lot of ways, define him forever. He talks about walking the streets of London, going shopping or going for a coffee and being surrounded by people and kind of being amazed that none of them have any idea of what he's been through, or this kind of shadow life that thousands of his countrymen are living, you know, all around us. So it's a story that's had got a happy ending in one sense, but he was one of the lucky ones. If Duncan Lewis hadn't found him in immigration detention, he'd still be there, or he'd be back in Vietnam. The last figure that we've got from the Ministry of Justice is that 12% of modern slavery victims, so those that the government have accepted have been enslaved in the UK, get discretionary leave to remain.
It's tiny.
It's tiny. And we have no idea how many victims of slavery get kind of pulled into the asylum system and then get those asylum applications turned down, because once they go into that asylum system, they're seen as an asylum seeker and not a victim of slavery.
But is the truth, Annie, that we're all happy to turn a blind eye to people being trafficked into this country if it means people can get their nails painted cheaply or think it's okay to buy cannabis very easily?
I would say it's more than likely that the 39 people who died in that trailer last week were destined for the same kind of work that Min and others have ended up in the UK doing. So whether it's Min in a cannabis house or someone in a nail bar, they are the kind of end point of the spending choices that we're making as we go about our day-to-day lives. So, you know, until we're prepared to think differently about how we are living our lives and the choices we're making, then the business model for this kind of exploitation will continue to thrive.
Individual stories like Min's might not be the ones that make people take notice of this huge problem of modern slavery in the UK, but will the discovery of those 39 bodies in Essex change anything?
I really hope so. I mean, you know, 2004, the tragedy of the Morecambe Bay cockle pickers, I think for many people that kind of raised, you know, the spectre of modern slavery in the UK for the first time and start paving the way towards that 2015 modern slavery legislation. The terrible tragedy of those 39 deaths last week might hopefully try and make us all think about what is happening in plain sight around us and why it is that people are in the position where they are locked inside a refrigerated truck in their desperate attempt to reach the UK.
Annie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've come across someone who might be a victim of slavery, you can call the Salvation Army's confidential helpline on 0300 303 8151. You can read more of Annie's reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, all eyes on the England rugby team tomorrow as they fight for World Cup glory. Now, on Saturday, pubs across England will be opening up earlier than usual as fans cram in to watch the Rugby World Cup final. In Japan, the England team have defied all expectations, and lots of people say that's thanks to their coach, Eddie Jones. For The Guardian's Rob Kitson, who's followed the team throughout the competition, this is a match no one should miss.
We've got a massive match awaiting us this weekend. What a final it's going to be. The excitement's been building all week steadily here in Tokyo. England and South Africa, they've been here for 8 weeks now, and it all boils down to 80 minutes in Yokohama on Saturday. We've been all over the country with England. We've been up to Sapporo, where they had their opening match. Right down south, they were in Miyazaki, right on the south coast to start with. Then we're in Kobe, unbelievably humid in Kobe, inside the dome there. I was tapping my report and there was sweat literally coming off my fingers onto the keyboard. It was that humid. We've been to Tokyo. This was always going to be a groundbreaking tournament. It's Japan's first time as host. There's never been a Rugby World Cup in Asia. And We've had typhoons, we've had New Zealand going out, you've had England playing better than expected, you've had Japan thrilling us all. I think the locals have really taken to it in a way perhaps they didn't expect. I think they weren't quite sure what would be arriving on their doorstep. But this weekend, it's hard to describe, but Tokyo is a massive metropolis, and it's not as if you're in Twickenham, where every pub or every corner is sort of rugby centric. Having said that, you don't have to go far to find rugby supporters. When Eddie Jones turned up 4 years ago, he said to us all, he said, "I don't want to be a popular Australian like Dame Edna Everidge. I just want to give English rugby a winning team." And it's taken him a while. He's had some ups and downs. They finished fifth in the Six Nations only last year. But slowly but surely, he's got them fit. He's got them organised. He's got them thinking clearly. He's got them taking responsibility. And their extraordinary semi-final performance against New Zealand last week was an absolute example, really, to the rest of the world.
Fast-paced and fantastic. And it's England who come away as winners.
These guys are worthy, I think. They've worked hard enough. Mara Itoje, the Vunipola brothers, Owen Farrell, Sam Underhill, Tom Curry. These are developing players. They're still relatively young. This is, without question, the biggest game of their careers. Don't run away with the idea that this final is going to be one-sided or automatically going to go one way. South Africa are a very, very big side, as physical as any forward pack in the competition. They're well coached. They haven't won the tournament since 2007. They've got a massive incentive. And in Siya Kolisi, they've got potentially the first black captain to lift the Webb Ellis Cup if South Africa were to win. So these guys are motivated. They're big. They're strong. And they pose a pretty big barrier to English ambition. Not everybody will remember 2003, the last time England won a World Cup, but it really was a moment in time for people of a certain generation. Johnny Wilkinson's late drop goal is one of the great moments in British sport. There's something about a Rugby World Cup final that does unite the country, and I think this is another great chance to do precisely that. So for all of you who are going to be watching on Saturday morning, whether it's in your sitting rooms or down the pub, hopefully with a large breakfast, I'd say this, you're in for a treat. I think it'll be a heck of a game.
That was Rob Kitson. My thanks to him and Annie Kelly. And before I get to the credits, an announcement. It's a bit weird to wish yourself a happy birthday, but that's what I'm going to do because today is our first birthday. Anushka, myself, and the Today in Focus team would like to thank all of the Guardian journalists who have spoken to us over the past year, sharing their incredible stories from all over the world. And thank you for listening, for your reviews, tweets, and emails. We really love hearing from you, and we'd love to know what you'd like to hear more of on Today in Focus in the next 12 months. You can contact Anushka and I on Twitter, or leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Gacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.